You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated...
It is Wednesday, May 23, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. On the program today, Oscar award-winning documentary film director Charles Ferguson, director of No End in Sight, and the aforementioned Oscar award winner Inside Job, with a new book out, Predator Nation, to be talking to us about, well, those that financial sector and how they extract. We are their prey, ladies and gentlemen. We are their prey. Also on the program today, no surprise, but Iowa Republicans vying for the craziest bat-crap crazy Republicans in the nation. Still haven't seen Texas's platform yet, but it's going to be a close call. Also, ungodly penguins. FISA looks like it's heading for an extension, despite the fact that two senators have been continuously warning us on the way that FISA is being interpreted by the U.S. government. Broadcasters really, really don't want you to know how much money they take in and advertisements from politicians. I wonder why. I wonder why that might be. We will get to that more. A programming note, tomorrow on the program, Jesselyn Raddick, a National Security and Human Rights Director with the Government Accountability Project, will be joining us, along with Thomas Drake, NSA whistleblower. We will be talking to both of them tomorrow. I'm sure he might have something to say about the FISA extension. And before we go to Charles Ferguson, just want to point out this story via Atrios at the blog Eschaton. He links to this story and mentions MF Global. And in the context of talking to Charles Ferguson, whose latest Predator Nation is very much about the rampant criminality that permeates our financial sector in this country. When you're talking about things like MF Global, remember that story, MF Global? Well, like $1 billion+ accidentally of client money was accidentally gambled away by the investment firm. I mean, it happens. And then the money ended up in, I think it was some like J.P. Morgan accounts. I'm not sure. But, you know, that happens. And you'll remember all those pictures of those people not being perp walked, whether it was John Corzine or any of them. However, this guy, Joe Bucci, of the Bensalem Township, a 22-year-old man, found $69,000 mistakenly deposited in his bank account. He spent most of the money to buy food, clothing, furniture, a car, airline tickets, and a pet dog. And Wells Fargo accidentally put it in his account. By the time the bank discovered the error, he only had $2,000 remaining. He has now been arrested and released on $25,000 unsecured bail. Steal a little, they throw you in prison. Steal a lot, and they'll probably appoint you Treasury Secretary, as far as I can tell at this point. I don't know. Maybe you'll become governor or a VP of something.
It's because he accidentally stole it. That's why he's getting punished. If you purposefully steal, like if you know what you're doing.
The MF Global, that was a big mistake. We didn't. I saw this pile of money. I didn't realize it was our clients. It was $1 billion bill, and then like a $500 million bill. And I saw them on the counter, and I said, "What? I'm going to bet this." All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Charles Ferguson. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Joining me now via phone, the Oscar award-winning director of Inside Job, also the director of No End in Sight on the Iraq occupation, and now recent author of the just-released Predator Nation, Corporate Criminals, Political Corruption, and the Hijacking of America, Charles Ferguson. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me, sir.
You outline in your book, and you take this somewhat, I don't know if it's necessarily a step further, but certainly a step further than we see our federal government taking it, wherein you talk about the tremendous amount of systemic criminality that not only led to the financial crisis, but seems to have permeated the entire financial sector in many other areas as well. Tell us where it goes beyond what perhaps Inside Job did.
Well, over the last 3 years, roughly since the crisis came to us, we've now accumulated a substantial, still very incomplete, very partial, but a substantial record of evidence from civil lawsuits and from several congressional and government investigations about what happened that led to the crisis. And we now know that there was a great deal of criminal behavior involved, very serious criminal behavior, and which, in my view, had a major role in generating the crisis.
Tell me about what your thoughts of this the recent financial fraud settlement, the 50-state settlement that was essentially organized by the feds, but every state attorney general ultimately signed on to it. Does that even begin to address even a fraction of what went on here?
No, unfortunately not. It's a very small settlement. It might seem odd characterizing something as very small when it involves billions of dollars, but here we're talking trillions of dollars and even tens of trillions of dollars. And this is something that, you know, had a major effect on the entire global economy, and continues to do so. Of course, you know, America still is quite troubled economically. So no, and unfortunately, that settlement and indeed, if you take all the settlements taken together, they're a tiny, tiny fraction of what's involved here.
Do you have a sense as to Eric Schneiderman's intentions? I mean, he was one of the last holdouts. He was placed on that the Financial Fraud Task Force, which has been so far, at least so far, somewhat anemic in its response. Do you have a sense of where he is in all of this?
Well, I haven't spoken to him for a while. When he first came into office, he and I had a few conversations. I think that he's a well-intentioned man whose powers are limited, and he's doing the best he can.
Tell me, one of the things, and I've seen you write that other people had a similar reaction, but one of the things that really stunned me in Inside Job, because, you know, to a certain extent, I had been following many of the issues that you covered. But the thing that really sort of stood out for me was the corruption of our academic institutions and academia in terms of them being bought off in so many ways. In ways that helped set the groundwork for the financial crisis, but in other ways, will you talk about that? Because I know that you came from academia, at least for one part in your career, and just give us your sense of that.
Well, what happened was that in parallel with the rise of money-based politics, with major interest groups, companies, industries, putting money into the political system, they started doing the same thing into the academic system because they recognized that from their point of view, a billion or two a year to several hundred or several thousand prominent professors in the United States was, from their point of view, a very good investment. And now we're at the point where in some disciplines that are very important to government policy, the economics of regulation, antitrust economics, things like that, what you'll find is that the overwhelming majority of the principal academic experts in those areas now receive most of their income from the industries and companies that they're supposed to be objectively examining. And that has become a major problem in policy debates.
Overall, what pushed you to write this book after having done, you know, I guess what could be considered the definitive documentary of the financial crisis, and certainly one that was recognized as winning the Academy Award? Why was that not enough in terms of your examining of these issues?
Well, in the first place, we've learned a lot more since then, and in the second place, I thought I could no longer be surprised and shocked, but actually I have been surprised and shocked and very disappointed that there have literally been no criminal prosecutions. And so I felt in the book that I wanted and needed to do two things that were kind of new and different from the film. The first is, in the book, I go through what we now know about, largely based on these court cases, but other things as well. A number of people have spoken out individually, for example. I go through what we now know about the criminal behavior that led to the crisis. And so I name a lot of names and give a lot of facts and make it very, very clear that there was massive criminality here and that it has gone unpunished. And the second thing that I wanted to do was I wanted to connect what happened with the financial industry and the financial crisis to the larger picture of how money-based politics and financial deregulation have contributed to America's economic problems. And so the second half of the book is largely about that in again, you know, quite considerable detail.
And you also go on to argue that we're living in some regards a plutocracy and that the tremendous amount of money that's sort of seeping into politics is fundamentally threatening at least some elements of our democracy. Give me a sense of when you think this started. I mean, you know, I have spoken to many people who have approached this topic in many different ways, and I'm very curious as to What you think, how did this happen? I mean, I've read different places where you talk about seeing a difference in perspective on people complaining about getting having to pay 15% capital gains tax when, you know, you as an entrepreneur, when you were dealing with investors like this, you never saw anything like that. When do you think this happened? What caused this change?
Well, I think it started in the mid to late 1970s with and then sharply accelerated in the 1980s with America, the beginning of America's economic difficulties, the two oil shocks, the rise of Japanese competition and Asian competition in the automobile and electronics industries. And what happened was twofold. One, there was this movement led by many academics, many prominent academics, including some who made a lot of money from it, for deregulation of the financial system and of industry generally. And secondly, a lot of American companies and industries started to sense that they could free themselves of regulation and or protect themselves from competition by investing in, by which I really mean corrupting, the political system. And that's it's in that period in the early 1980s where you see for the first time the very sharp rise of money in politics. And between the late 1970s and currently, the cost of running for president has gone up by a factor of 20. And the same is true for running for Congress. The amount of money spent in congressional campaigns and presidential campaigns has gone up by a factor of 20. And now it's many billions of dollars every election cycle, and that's a tremendously dangerous thing.
I mean, do you think there was something that changed in the values that we have as a society? Because it's, you know, it's one thing to talk about these corporations using their money to affect political outcomes, and it's another for academics to and I think there's an argument that it's, you know, across different professions we saw sort of like the internal code of ethics, and maybe they never existed, but it seems as if there was a sort of a degradation of ethics sort of across the board.
Yes, I think that's right. It's been a gradual thing, but you know there's a complicated relationship between people's economic incentives and their kind of attitudes and what happens to culture generally. And gradually, what happened is that things that used to be considered socially unacceptable and ethically improper came to be increasingly widespread, increasingly financially attractive, and gradually they came to be accepted as normal. And that's, I think, one important part of what happened in the financial system is that gradually, as unethical and even criminal behavior went unpunished, it became more and more common. And as it became more and more common, people entering the financial system and moving up in it started to feel that this was just normal because it was everywhere.
Interesting. And you know, so we have the savings and loans where, you know, some people went to jail. We had the Keating Five, and we had, I think it was at least hundreds of prosecutions. We go through this process, and it's almost as if there's a sort of a corrective quality to putting people in jail, that it sort of resets things and is sort of like a cold shower on some of this. Without it, we're setting something up even worse, aren't we?
Yes, I'm afraid so, yeah. And the S&L crisis of the 1980s was the last time that we actually punished this kind of behavior. We did punish it. Several thousand people were prosecuted. Several hundred people went to prison, including some quite senior financial executives.
Is being so enmeshed in what took place in terms of the criminality in the finance sector, and then seeing the almost total lack of criminal response. I mean, and also, you know, as you're aware, even when these companies get charged with violations, they never have to admit any guilt, and they're basically just told, okay, now you have to obey the law. And more often than not, they come back in a couple of years and they get the same the essential scold, essentially. Has this radicalized you, do you think?
I wouldn't say that it's radicalized me. It's, you know, I think that my general political and policy views are kind of the same, but I think, unfortunately, the country has changed, and our political system has changed, and so it's gotten me disturbed. I would say I'm alarmed at what's happened.
And what do you think how does this get unwound?
Well, I think that, and this is, you know, simultaneously an optimistic and a pessimistic answer, I think that it's going to take a substantial groundswell, grassroots, bottom-up kind of social movement, whether it's inside one of the existing political parties or a third party or a nonpartisan movement like, you know, the women's movement, for example. Or some combination of those. I don't know. But I think that, unfortunately, now where we're at in our political system, it's unlikely to come from the top. I think it's going to come from below, and that takes time and it's hard. But on the other hand, we've done it before, and so, you know, I hope that over the next decade, for example, we might see the emergence of a movement like that.
Will it have to get much worse? I mean, it seems to me that we are currently still going through an economic crisis. We've been in that crisis for almost 3.5 years now, 4 years almost, and the impetus to do something seems to have been co-opted by our government in some ways.
Yes, unfortunately, that's true. Yeah,
and do you have a sense that things are going to have to get much worse until people are in a position to sort of push through that reluctance?
Possibly. You know, it's hard to tell. These things are unpredictable, both in the United States and elsewhere. You know, and until the Arab Spring erupted, nobody would have predicted that it would erupt. And, you know, indeed, those countries had been stable under very unpleasant dictatorships for decades, and then suddenly things erupted. So it's very hard to tell what will make people finally say that they've had enough. It might take things getting worse. You know, I hope not, but it might. It might take another crisis. It might take another financial crisis a decade from now.
And lastly, I mean, your book came out more or less at the same time that J.P. Morgan reported. I guess at the time they had reported $2 billion. Now it's up, I think, to 3 or 5 or 6 billion, depending on what reports you read. And I suspect that it's going to go higher. Are there specific? I mean, is it simply a matter of Glass-Steagall, or would have Glass-Steagall prevented the financial crisis, or would it have gone at least a certain distance to preventing that financial crisis that would have been made up by the difference in culture? What would it take statutorily to sort of insulate us from, you know, what they seem to enjoy doing on Wall Street?
Glass-Steagall is one part of it, and the Volcker Rule, a strong, really tough, credible version of the Volcker Rule would be another part of it, and re-regulation of derivatives would certainly be a third part of it. I'm not speaking now about this recent J.P. Morgan trading loss, but with regard to the financial crisis, just simple law enforcement, just enforcement of existing laws would have actually had a major effect in reducing the size of the bubble and the size of the crisis.
And do you think that there's been any, in terms of those regulatory agencies, do you think there's been any accountability in terms of those people who did not enforce existing laws?
So far, unfortunately, not. The Obama administration has been very disappointing in several regards. It's been very disappointing in its personnel appointments. It's appointed to major regulatory positions people who were part of the problem and who are therefore not likely to be part of the solution. It has not proposed very strong reforms, and of course there have been no criminal prosecutions. So the Obama administration has been a huge disappointment in that regard.
Do you have any reason to believe that that's going to change in the event that Obama is reelected?
Who knows? Who knows?
Indeed. Well, Charles Ferguson, author of Predator Nation, Corporate Criminals, Political Corruption, and Hijacking of America, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, sir.
Okay, we're going to take a break, folks. Quick break here. When we come back, we will we'll tell you a... What do I have here? Well, we have a couple of different stories that I think you're going to enjoy. And I guess we got to play that clip of Bill O'Reilly, who apparently is very nervous about what's going on with this Occupy thing. He seems very nervous about it because it's starting to hit home. When a guy can't go out on that on theater, you know, to see Jesus Christ, superstar of all things. My God. No pun intended. We'll take a break. We'll be right back after this. Take the skinheads bowling. Take them bowling. Take the skinheads bowling. Take them bowling. Some people say that bowling alley's got big lanes. Got big lanes. Got big lanes. Some people say that bowling alleys all look the same. Look the same. Look the same. There's not a line that... We are back. So we've talked about what took place in Chicago. We had thousands of people protesting. We had military vets essentially, well, not even essentially, literally tossing their medals towards the doors, or at least as close as one could get to the doors of where the NATO meetings were taking place. And denouncing the medals and expressing, I think we posted that video on majority.fm yesterday, right, of these military vets who were, you know, expressing sometimes remorse or just in some respects some sense of emancipation. And meanwhile, in Montreal, protests continue on there. And hopefully will be an inspiration to this country. But yesterday, Tuesday, marked the 100th day of demonstrations over tuition increase of $1,600, which is going to be implemented over several years. But you have, and police won't provide crowd estimates, but thousands upon thousands of tens of thousands of protesters were marching on Tuesday and doing so despite the fact that they were told by the Quebec government that you need to sort of register all these protests and you need to give us a protest route. And apparently they broke off into three different groups. One group followed the route, and the other two didn't. And it didn't seem like there was much the Quebec government could do about it. There was, I think, about 300 people arrested over the weekend, 20 injured. And bringing the total number of arrests up to about 1,000. So students are striking in Montreal, and what's interesting is to see the news reports to see how many people in that society are rallying around the protesters and their right to demonstrate. And there appears to be far more black bloc tactics used by these folks in Quebec than we see generally in protests in this country. And yet, the people there still feel that what Quebec is doing in trying to curtail their First Amendment rights is wrong. So, I somebody keep my seat warm up there. Nikki was parked, supposedly was eligible for Canadian citizenship because her grandfather was like one quarter Canadian, and she tried to get it too late. Then they put some type of moratorium on it. And that was, we found that out after I agreed to get married to her. So I thought I could get that dual citizenship. So, and nevertheless, that's not important for the conversation. What is important, though, is that Bill O'Reilly seems to be terrified of what is going on in this country in terms of protest. And obviously because of the potential for violence and upheaval, but really, more importantly, what he perceives is going on with the Occupy movement, how they apparently are keeping him monitored and sending back to HQ. This is pretty heady stuff, folks. O'Reilly blows the lid off of what's going on with Occupy based upon one guy who came up to him after O'Reilly saw a play or was going to a play. I can't remember what it was. But this is fantastic because, when Bill, the idea that Bill O'Reilly could get accosted by someone who thought he was a D-bag is just not possible. It has to be a larger political conspiracy that is approaching Bill O'Reilly because, of course, it's Bill O'Reilly. Let's listen to Bill explain, blow the lid off of this. This almost like the secret group that is monitoring him. Go ahead.
People showed up in Washington dressed in black. They all knew where to go. They all knew what to do. It was very well coordinated. And on a personal note, on Friday, I went to see a play called Jesus Christ Superstar on Broadway. I had three kids with me. When I left the theater, I was confronted by an Occupy Wall Street guy who was very obnoxious, came within inches of my face. I told him there were children present. He didn't care. Actually chased the car down the street. Now, that wasn't an accident. Somebody had seen me going in or in the theater, had texted the Occupy people who dispatched this guy to chase me down. Now, this is what's happening across the country, and I think people should know about it.
Ironic that you're a Jesus Christ superstar, and they didn't have tolerance about
this. It's the same thing that what happened in Washington to me. He wanted me to. He wanted me to attack him. It was obvious what he was doing. And the driver of the car that I was in even tried to get in. This guy was out of control. What I'm trying to say is not just about me. This Occupy Wall Street movement is now very coordinated, and they are terrorists. They are trying to create trouble. That's what terrorists do. They're not on the par of Al-Qaeda, but they are trying to create trouble, manufacture and contrive trouble.
Bill, imagine if this were some type of...
There you go, folks. Bill O'Reilly realizes now that the Occupy movement is everywhere. They're monitoring his theater-going activities. My guess is just some guy who had the opportunity to say, oh, my God, there's Bill O'Reilly. He's a real moron, and I'm going to tell him. But no. It was much more nefarious than that. All right, folks. I think that's it for the better half today. Tomorrow on the program, NSA whistleblowers, including Thomas Drake. Folks, this program completely depends on your support. Completely. And It's you know, this is the only way that the show can survive is if you people become members. And I'm not talking to the members who are already members. I'm talking to the thousands of rest of you. We need your support. One of you guys has to look in the mirror. Actually, like five of you or six of you today need to look in the mirror and go, am I going to stand up for this? Am I going to head over to majority.fm right now and become a member? Spend that 33 cents a day that it costs, maybe, to just keep this show alive? Yes, I will. Hopefully that's what you'll say. All right, folks, many other ways to support this program. If you can't bring yourself to support it by becoming a member, you can use our Amazon link, buy merch, donateyouraccount.com. Come on. Seriously, donateyouraccount.com/majorityfm.
We are one away from 1,000 social media donations to our Donate Your
Account. Let's do this, people. Come on. Seriously. You're embarrassing Kyle. He made it for us. Now he's just watching other people walking away with it. JustCoffee.coop. Fair trade coffee, tea, chocolate, organic. 10% discount code. Majority. You want to call into the program, 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. We welcome conservative callers, welcome libertarian callers today. And, of course, you can IM me at Majority FM. See you in the better half.